PuraTap know how to make our water more beautiful. They're also really big on making the planet more beautiful. So, ditch the single plastics and fill your reusable water bottle with PuraTap. The planet and your taste buds will thank you for it. Hi everyone, welcome to Conversations. Bea Birtle is one of our most talented musical and most successful musical talents. He is back in Adelaide for his Fringe show on the 22nd, well, this Friday, as a matter of fact. It's called An Evening of Zoot, Mississippi, and LRB, Little River Band. Legendary. I'm almost not worthy to have him in the same studio.
Oh, stop it.
Bea Birtle, welcome to the program.
Hi, Graham. How are you?
I'm good, thanks.
That's good. You know,
I feel a kindred spirit, not because of the musical instrument, but we're similar ages. We grew up in working class conditions, I guess, post-war baby boomers.
That's right.
But your story is interesting because you emigrated with your family, didn't you?
Yeah, yeah. My family came out from Holland, from Amsterdam, where I grew up, in 1959. And for some reason, my parents decided to want to settle in Adelaide. And so
your dad was a tradesman too, wasn't
he? He was, yeah. You know, in Holland, when the Dutch government put on these film nights, you could go along and see what life was like in Kenya and New Zealand and California and Australia. And being a carpenter, he decided that, you know, Australia was the place where he wanted to immigrate.
Was it tough? I mean, I knew Dutch immigrants when I was a kid, and they had to live at the Glenelg Hostel when they first came. Did you have to do that?
Yeah, we were at Fensbury on Grand Junction Road.
So you were a kid going to school at 9 or 10 years of age.
Yeah, I was 10 years old. Couldn't speak a word of English.
How did that go?
And, well, we were all just thrown together in school and, you know, within a year, you were speaking the language kind of thing.
Did you feel you were discriminated against? Was it tough?
No, never, never. And I really embraced football and cricket the minute I went. I went to Pennington Primary School.
Well, don't tell me you're back for Port Adelaide.
No. No. Actually, back in those days, I was a Norwood fan.
Oh, okay. Port fans wouldn't like that.
But, Finsbury... we were there for a very short time, actually, because I got sick.
Oh, did you?
Yeah, the hand-washing facilities there were so bad, and I got stuck in Northfield Infectious Hospital.
What with?
It was called yellow fever back in those days.
Yeah. Quite serious.
Kind of a hepatitis type of thing, I don't know, but... I was there for 3 weeks, and of course, when I was released from the hospital, my mother would have put her foot down with my dad and said, there's no way we're going back to the Finsbury Hostel. So he went to the bank and got a loan for a block of land, and he bought a block of land in Netley, which is where I grew up.
Does the family still own the house?
No, but the last time we were back here, we drove by.
Did you?
I was shown the people that were picked me up. I was shown, this is the house where I grew up. My father built this house, you know. And very humble conditions, because when we bought the block of land, there was nothing there. It was just, you know, it looked like it was all sand. And my dad put up a corrugated iron garden shed, and which was their bedroom, our dining room, washing facilities, you name it. And then he rented a caravan for a year, and that was my sister in my bedroom.
Gosh.
And we lived like that. There was no running water. I had to walk to our nearest neighbors with a couple of buckets every day to get fresh water. No electricity.
Oh, you love that story, don't you?
I love that story. It's fantastic. And then we saw the foundation of the house being laid and the bricks going up and all of that. So we actually moved into that house on Christmas Eve, 1960.
What a Christmas present.
Yeah, exactly.
So was Australia good to your mum and dad, do you think?
Oh, very good, very good. I mean, my dad took the chance to come out here for a better life for him and his family. Mm. But they were both working people. You know, my dad worked hard all of his life, and my mother did too, you know.
That generation did, though. They didn't know anything but work. Yeah. Did they ever go back to Holland? Did they feel the urge to go back?
Well, they went back for visits. My mum in particular was quite homesick the first few years. But my dad, he lived for his work. He was all about his work, and so it didn't bother him, you know. wasn't really homesick.
Did you always have a musical talent? Did it come from within the family?
Well, my parents were both amateur operetta singers. They performed in Amsterdam when we were still living there. And my mum played the piano a little bit, and a little bit of piano accordion.
I read where your mother taught you how to sing harmony.
Yeah,
one of the great mysteries to those of who have limited talent is how to harmonise.
Well, it was kind of a natural thing in a way, but, you know, I'd be standing at the sink with my mum, helping her, you know, dry the dishes or whatever, and she'd always sing some kind of melody, and I would just add my voice to hers and...
What are some of the Dutch arias? Did she sing in Dutch or did she sing in Italian?
You know, I don't remember that, actually.
It
would have been songs that were popular when we were living here. Okay. You know, songs that they were playing on the radio at the time.
The Happy Wanderer.
Yeah. You know, and back then it was pre-Beatles, so it was people like... Roy Orbison or Connie Francis or the Everly Brothers.
Did you start playing an instrument at a young age?
I was taught the piano accordion when I was about 8 years old in Holland. Oh. So I had 2 years of you know, learning to read music and play that instrument. But, you know, the minute that we arrived in Australia, the piano accordion kind of took
It wasn't cool.
Yeah, no, it wasn't cool to be playing piano accordion.
So you picked up a guitar?
Yeah, I got. I was given a guitar for my 15th birthday, but it was a right-handed guitar. You couldn't get left-handed instruments in those days.
But why can't? Why? There's so few left-handed guitarists, though. Why? I mean, I know some great ones.
Yeah.
But there's so. Why do? You, why are you left-handed?
I'm naturally left-handed, and back in those days, there weren't many left-handed instruments to be found.
See, this puzzles me. With a guitar, all the intricate work is done with if I'm a right hander with the left hand, and
right,
all the fingering and that.
Right.
Why is it so hard to do it with the right hand, or in your case, the left hand?
I don't know. The minute I was given that guitar, I flipped it over. And
so, when did you start playing in a band?
Oh, that came later. My second year, I went to Plimpton High.
Yeah, good school.
Yeah.
Good football school, actually.
Mm-hmm. And my first year was in 1963. And in 1964, I met an English migrant, John Darcy, who came from Manchester, England. And he did stay at the Glenelg. His family was at the Glenelg Migrant Hostel. And they weren't there for a very long time because they ended up moving to Christie's Beach. But John and I would start getting together at each other's places. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the Hollies were from his hometown. So the Hollies were like a huge influence with him.
And you could sing the harmony?
And I was singing, you know, harmonies on Holly songs and other songs as well. But we did a lot of Holly stuff, yeah.
So... You finished high school. Did you have a career ambition?
Yes. I didn't finish high school, I'm sorry to say.
Well, in one way, I did.
But,
you left high school.
Yeah, I left high school, and but I, you know, by then I was playing with Zoot.
By then?
Oh, yeah, then? Yeah.
How old were you? Did I read they held you back a year because of your language?
Yeah,
so you're a bit older than the other
That
kids?
Happened in primary school.
Okay.
They held me back because of the language barrier, you know. So, yeah, I was a year older than most of the kids in my class.
So what stage did you get together with Zoot? So that's Rick Springfield and Daryl Cotton.
Yeah, that was later on after the group had moved to Melbourne.
Oh,
but,
okay.
You know, there were a good 4 years here where we, you know, climbed the ladder of the Adelaide scene and became more, one of the
famous
top Adelaide
Famous. Yeah. Zoot. And it was Pink Zoot for a while, wasn't it?
It was, yeah.
How long?
Yeah.
Very briefly, Pink Zoot.
Yeah. Yeah, I'd probably a good 3 years of that, wearing the pink stuff.
Now, for a brief time, I worked in the laboratory at the Chrysler factory down at Lonsdale. And one of the Zoot boys, and I always thought it was you, worked on the production line.
Yeah, that was me.
That was you.
Mm-hmm.
So,
yeah. Well, how that came about was I actually had a 2-year apprenticeship as a ceramic tiler. And I did that for 2 years. And then I had a bit of a run-in with the boss and told him where to go, and then I, because we were, this was leading up to the time when Zoot was leaving Adelaide to go to Melbourne, and I thought I better save up some money, so I applied for a job at Chrysler. It was in, you said it was Lonsdale, but yeah. I thought it was Christie's Beach.
Well, Port's the same deal.
Same thing.
Same area.
Yeah, and I worked on the production line, pulling this machine down, making parts for car doors or something.
Oh, you were such a good-looking guy. I was so envious, to be quite frank. In a band.
And because I lived in Netley, I didn't want to drive all the way to Christie's Beach every day for work. Mm-hmm. So I actually slept on the floor of Daryl Cotton's bedroom because he lived in Christie's Beach.
We'll talk about that. We've got to take a break. B. Birtles is my guest, folks. Yes, B. Birtles, Mississippi, Zoot, most famous for his time with Little River Band, of course, is my guest. Back shortly.
At Caltex StarMart and The Foodery, get all your essentials at your convenience safely, with increased cleaning and distancing measures now in place. That means you can shop quickly and safely in-store for things like bread, pasta, milk and toilet paper, with none of the crowds. We're open from early morning until late, so you can come in at a time that works for you. Head to Caltex StarMart and The Foodery and get all your essentials at your convenience. Product availability may vary by store while stocks last.
At Big W, we understand that now more than ever, every day's a big day at home. That's why we can help with all the essentials. Keep the kids entertained with crafts, puzzles, toys and more. We've even got your working from home wardrobe covered. Visit bigw.com.au for more ideas.
Okay, time for a quick PuraTap break. PuraTap. They make our water more beautiful, and they're big on making the planet more beautiful by encouraging the use of reusable water bottles. It's a war on waste, thanks to PuraTap. Thank you for joining us, folks. B. Birtles is back in town for his fringe show. We're exploring those early days where you're starting to find your way as a musician.
Yeah.
Tell us how you met Daryl Cotton and Rick Springfield. I mean, the Zoot was such a popular band, mm-hmm. and I think you won awards, and you were Bass Guitarist of the Year one year in the TV Week Awards.
Yeah, that's right.
How did you meet Daryl Cotton?
Well, Daryl was one of two lead singers in a group in Christie's Beach, and they were called the Mermen. And this was before we were called Zoot. We started off as Times Unlimited. And we were, you know, building our reputation mainly in the Christie's Beach, Port Nalunga area.
It's intriguing. You had Elizabeth in the north.
Yes.
Where a lot of British immigrants and a great breeding ground for pop groups.
Yeah.
And Christie's Beach was similar in the south, wasn't it?
It was. And they were kind of the two major English immigrant outposts in Adelaide. So we were lacking a lead singer. Because the three of us sang, but we were also playing our instruments at the same time. And Daryl expressed an interest in wanting to join the group. And so he did. And when he joined, we actually changed our name to a Hollies title, which was called Down the Line.
Yeah, and I remember that. Is the story that Doc Neeson from the Ages?
This is the story, yeah. We were approached, and I was speaking about the Elizabeth Salisbury area. That's where these two dance promoters came along, and they saw us play and said, well, we think you guys have a lot of potential, but we don't like your name. And so it was Doc who suggested that we change our name to Zoot, which doesn't really mean anything, but it's a punchy name.
Who came up with it?
And well, I think it was his admiration for the English group Zoot Money's Big Roll Band, who were getting some airplay back in those days. They were an English band. And so we kicked it around for maybe a week or so, and we thought, Zoot, you know, what a weird name, what a weird word, you know. But we finally thought, yeah, it's kind of cool, you know. So that's how we changed our name to Zoot. And, of course, our lineup was intact. The first lineup of Zoot was intact now with Daryl Cotton.
So there was only four.
Yeah, there were only four of us. Ted Higgins was on drums.
Well, Ted's still around the place.
Yes. And I was playing bass, and John Darcy was the guitar player, and then Daryl was the singer.
And were you coming up with your original songs, or did you have
No, we were just a cover band. None of us wrote music. We just did a lot of cover songs.
What were you singing?
We sang "Come See About Me" by the Supremes, and we did anything that was popular on radio at that time. You know, we would do. We were big fans of the English group The Move, so we would do "I Can Hear the Grass Grow" and songs like that. Yeah.
I think they passed me by The Move.
Did they? Oh, they had a lot of hits, actually.
Did they?
Yeah. But, and then we, somebody from Melbourne came across and spotted us, I'll tell you what happened. We were doing a show at the Glenelg Town Hall, and we were supporting the Twilights.
Right.
And Paddy McCartney, who was the other singer in the Twilights, thought we were great, and said to their record producer, "You really need to send somebody to check out Zoot because they're fabulous." So Wayne DeGrucci, who was a visionary manager from Melbourne, came across and saw the band play at Sgt. Pepper's. I remember this very well. And his goal was to find a new young band that he wanted to make Australia's next teenage sensation. And it was Wayne's idea to do the whole Pink thing.
Pink Zoot, I remember at the time, I think, what are they thinking?
Yeah. I know. It really alienated the guys from the girls, because the girls were all in love with us and the guys hated us.
Tell us about those times. I mean, they were manic. The teenage followings you had.
I tell you, back in those days, you know, you'd go and see a band and they'd play pretty much all night. But once again, Wayne, being the visionary he was, he would only let us get booked for 40-minute spots.
Mm.
And so we'd be, you know, at one, two, sometimes three different dances in Melbourne a night. And, you know, if you can imagine, these four guys dressed in pink hit the stage. They're only there for 40 minutes, and then they're off stage and going to their next gig. Well, the girls couldn't get enough of that. And so it's like they would even follow us from gig to gig, you know. And was the whole screaming thing came along, and then, you know, trying to tear Daryl's clothes off and all that sort of stuff, which happened a few times, actually. He had to leave the stage underwear.
He didn't mind.
No, he didn't mind.
There was a record cover of the four of you shot nude.
Yeah. Yeah.
Now, that would have been, from the rear, it wasn't full frontal, but it was rear.
Yes.
That must have been quite out there at the time.
Oh, it was outrageous at the time, you know. The reason that came about was after we dropped the whole Think Pink thing, Rick Springfield had written a song called Hey Pinky. And it was slamming the guys that used to, you know, knock us for wearing pink clothes. And we decided to do something outrageous about it. We went into a photographer's studio and dropped our dacks and had the photo taken, and it was the advertisement for the release of Hey Pinky. Well, it caused such an uproar in Go-Set, and of course all the gay boys couldn't get enough of it.
you mentioned Rick Spurley. Do you still keep in touch? I mean, it's amazing that these guys from Christie's Beach have spread so far and wide. He's become famous in a different area, different genre. He's a star. Do you keep in touch with him at all?
We email a lot whenever he comes to Nashville. We go to see his show, and of course Zoot got together for his in 2011 before Daryl passed away. We did the Rick Springfield and Friends cruise, which was like the 40th reunion of Zoot. And it was all the original guys got back together.
Was out of Miami, though, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was a 4-5-day cruise through the Caribbean.
So the Americans wouldn't have known much about Zoot, surely. They'd know Rick Springfield. No, but they know about Zoot?
Well, Rick's fan base. Mm-hmm. I mean, Rick Springfield's fan base, his female fan base, is phenomenal. And they know all about him. They know his history, what his mother's name is, you name it. They know everything about him.
Tell me his age. Tell me his hair's fallen out. Tell me something. He's such a good-looking guy.
No, he still is. He's still good.
It's not fair.
Well, he does dye his hair. He doesn't mind me saying that because it's true. Because we were having the conversation one day and somebody asked him, he said, how come your hair hasn't gone grey? He said, oh, I'm as grey as babies. I just dye my hair.
But Zoot broke up.
Yeah.
Your big song was Eleanor Rigby.
Eleanor Rigby,
Beatles cover.
Yeah, yeah.
Did you think it would take off?
Yeah.
Did you hesitate about doing a Beatles cover?
No, we didn't hesitate about doing a Beatles cover. It was really our record producer who insisted that we do it because we had performed it at the Hoadley's Battle of the Sounds in Sydney, which is the national one.
Yeah.
And Zoot lost to the Flying Circus.
Oh, okay.
But we had performed Eleanor Rigby live on that show. And it was recorded by 2SM in Sydney. And 2SM started playing the live version on the radio. And Howard Gable, who was our record producer, very quickly found out about it. And he said, you guys got to go into the studio and record this thing. It's going to be your next single. And so we did.
Pete Birtles is my guest, folks. I love the journey from Dutch immigrant settles in Adelaide and becomes this massive global musical star. We'll find out how that happens when we come back shortly. Thanks for joining us, folks. B. Birtles is back in town. He's for his show. It's an evening of Zoot, Mississippi and LRB. It's at Grand Central on the 22nd of Friday night, 22nd of February. And get along. It's a great journey. We've talked about the Zoot days with Daryl Cotton, Rick Brewer and Rick Springfield, of course.
Yes.
You're the same age as me.
Uh-huh.
Same year.
Yes.
I got called up in 1968.
Yeah.
Did you?
Yeah, I did get called up. My number, 28 of November, was called up. But I was deferred for a year because of being not having Australian nationality. I was still Dutch.
Yeah.
So, you know, by this time, Zoot's becoming really popular around Australia. And finally, after the year, I got the letter from the army saying I had to show up for my medical and everything. Yeah. And, you know, you had to fill out all of these forms and stuff. You know, in the meantime, Normie Rowe had gone over there.
Yeah.
And the army, you know, hadn't been kind to
his
music career.
Nothing.
And so I thought, I really don't want to go. I want to pursue my music, you know. So I filled out and I had all these questions about medical conditions and stuff. And all these guys around me, you know, other musicians just said, oh, yeah, if you get up your sugar intake, it'll, you know, they'll think you're a diabetic and all these sort of things. And I thought, nah, too many guys are doing this, you know. I'm going a different direction. So on the list was the question, are you a bedwetter? And I ticked it. I said, oh, yes, I'm a perpetual bedwetter.
No.
Yeah, I'm serious. And guys asking me questions and saying, you know, well, okay, so you're a bedwetter. You're going to be sent to a psychiatrist for an evaluation. And sure enough, another letter came in the mail, and I went to see the psychiatrist. And he's asking me questions like, well, do you know, that you can get pills for that nowadays? And I said, well, no, I don't know about that because my doctor keeps telling me it's a psychological problem. And, you know, I'm just going by what he says. And he's asking me all these questions and I'm sweating it out. And then, you know, I'm trying to size him up, so I think, you know, because I wanted to tell him the truth.
Yeah.
And in the end, I did.
It's hard to lie, isn't it?
It is. And I took a chance and I said, look, I said, it's not that I want to go into the army because I love this country and I will fight for this country, you know. But, you know, my music career is just starting to take off and the army would just pull the rug out from under it, you know.
Yeah.
And he kept a very straight face. I couldn't tell what he was saying or thinking. And he said, oh, well, that'll be all for now. And he showed me to the door and I walked down the hall towards the lift. And just about as I was getting on the lift, he said, oh, by the way, Gerard, he called out to me. He said, you'll probably be declined for the army.
Okay.
And I got the letter in the mail saying that, you know, because of my bedwetting condition, I wasn't accepted.
Did you ever get teased about that?
Well, It's a really funny story. Actually, I write about it in detail in my memoir that I released last year. And there's a few funny stories in it. But not that many people zoom in on it, no.
Actually, he called you by your first name, Gerard.
Yes, Gerard.
Bertelkamp.
Bertelkamp, yeah. How Dutch can that be?
Bertels is sort of better, isn't it?
Yeah, it is.
Do you ever have to use your real name?
Ever since 9/11, I can't get away with B. Bertels anymore. Okay. I've got to go by what's stamped on my passport.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
So we use the Bertelkamp a lot more nowadays.
So Zoot's finished.
Yeah.
And you join a band called Mississippi.
Right.
And then you go to London.
Yes.
You have the odd record with Mississippi. They were sort of soft rock, weren't they?
More like a Crosby, Stills and Nash kind of, very harmony oriented as well.
Yeah.
We had their big hit was Kings of the World, and then after I joined the band, we had two singles: a song called Early Morning and Will I. And Will I kind of was released on the eve of us going to England because we didn't feel we were getting the support from radio. Okay. With that song, and decided that we would seek our fame and fortune in England, which was very short-lived.
Yeah, that's been not many have succeeded in England.
No,
have they?
No. Not many Australian bands.
No. Oh, that's what I mean, not many Australian bands. So you broke up in England, is that?
Yeah, we broke up in England.
So tell us about how traumatic is that when you're over there and you decide it's going to finish?
We were kind of forced to break up because we'd gone over with a certain amount of money and it ran out, basically. And the kind of gigs we were playing over there were just terrible, you know. So, but before we broke up, I knew that Glenn Shorrock was living over there. And he wasn't doing much in England either. He was singing back up for Cliff Richard and
because Terry Britton, who was from the Twilights,
yes,
played in Cliff Richard's band and produced Cliff
Richard's
songs.
So I rang Glenn up and I said, what are you doing? You know, he said, well, I'm thinking about going back to Australia because I've just been hitting my head against the brick wall over here for the last 5 years. And I said to him, well, you know, we're going back to Australia as well. Do you think we could get together and do something? So he came over to the house where Graham and I were living in London.
Graham Goble.
Just to play each other, you know, some songs we'd written. And, of course, one of the first things was we tried our vocals together on Graham's It's a Long Way There.
Yeah.
And just in the living room, you know, when we heard the blend between our voices, we knew immediately that we had something.
It's almost a Crosby, Stills and Nash moment, isn't
story,
it? Where the three guys get together and their voices blend so beautifully.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And it doesn't always happen in bands. You know, there are certain magic combinations. I think the Hollies.
What was the song you sang?
It's a Long Way There.
Just give us a couple of bars of it.
People on their own are getting nowhere. I'm on the road to see.
And now you got a higher part, or was Graham got the higher part?
Yeah. Now I always sang above Glenn.
Yeah.
And then Graham had a very, very strong falsetto voice, and he would sing the high parts.
So you find your gel vocally.
Yeah.
But how does a band all of a sudden emerge from that?
Right. Well, the three of the Mississippi guys, Derek Pellicci, the drummer, Graham and myself, had already decided we were going to reform the group. We just weren't sure whether we were going to do that in England or come back to Australia to do it. So when Glenn Shorrock said, oh, I'm going back to Australia, that was our decision to go back as well. So we had the four members already of the group, and all we needed was a bass player and a guitar player.
You play bass?
No, I switched to guitar. after Zoot broke up, I stopped playing bass, and I picked up a guitar just like you did.
Oh, yeah.
And I was really awful in the beginning. I was really bad. But somehow I got pretty good.
It didn't work for me. When did you realise? I mean, you became so big. You became a massive band in Australia. You went to America. You were the first Australian band to really make it big in America.
Yeah.
What was the moment? Was there a public moment where you realised this was it?
I think it was more the speed at which it happened.
Yeah.
We got signed very quickly to EMI. We recorded our first album, and almost a year to the release of that album in Australia, Glenn Wheatley, our manager, had gone over to LA to score a record deal for us over there, and he secured a record deal with Capitol Records. So almost a year later, that same album was released in America.
Wow.
And we started going on the road.
Just before we go to the break quickly,
yeah.
So all the success you had with Zoot and Mississippi,
yeah.
was there any money left out of that? Did you make any money out of it all?
Not really, no. No, it was kind of, you know, when people say living from paycheck to paycheck, it was pretty much all of that during those two bands.
Bee Birtles is my guest, folks. Back shortly. Welcome back, folks. Bee Birtles from Little River Band, of course, prior to that, Zoot and Mississippi, one of our great South Australian musical... Well, we've exported you, really. You just come back to visit. I mean,
yeah.
You're living in America now, aren't you?
Yeah, I've been there for 27 years now.
But LRB has taken off. You've been back in Australia with Glenn Shorrock and Graham Gobels.
Mm-hmm.
There's no S on it, Graham Gobel.
Yeah.
And the band has taken off here in Australia, and the record's selling well in America.
Yes.
So you go to America.
Yeah.
Which everyone... Did you do that with some trepidation?
No. We first went to Europe, and we supported the Hollies.
Really?
On a European tour, but that was the first part of it. And then we went to America and started...
Did you have any jams, any sing-alongs with the Holly boys?
No, but we used to hang out with them in the hotels. And, of course, you know, whenever you admire somebody, you've got 1,000 questions you want to ask them.
Yeah. Yeah, okay.
But, yeah, no, America was good. We started off supporting other people. Mm-hmm. I remember our very first show in America was at a college somewhere in Virginia, and we supported the Average White Band. Yeah. So we got to play with some really amazing people. But, you know, as the band became more popular through radio, eventually we started headlining our own shows.
But also, your love life intervenes here, because you're 30-odd years old. You haven't been married.
No. Mm.
But you meet your wife, Donna.
Yes, yes. She was working for the booking agent who booked Little River Band. And
probably a good age to be for a rock star to think about settling down, all the other stuff out of the way.
Yeah, it was for me because, you know, my wild years were behind me, and I was ready to start a family.
So tell us about Donna, your wife.
Yeah, she...
She's sitting very quietly in the corner, folks, if you're wondering, so she's hearing all of this. We can't get her to say anything.
She was instrumental in helping our road crew out with equipment that we needed because we're an Australian band, you know, in America kind of thing. So a week before her birthday in July, the road crew came to us and said, look, Donna's been fantastic to you guys. Would you consider flying her out for the show that we're doing at the Cotton Bowl in Dallas? Huge show.
Yeah.
Fleetwood Mac, Steve Miller Band, Little River Band, a guy called Bob Welsh, and Billy Thorpe.
Looking to make an important study decision but don't know where to start? At Open Universities Australia, we'll help you simplify the process. From which degree to which university, we'll help you compare and choose what's right for you so you can take your career to the next level. Find the right online study choice for you all in one place. Start at open.edu.au. Open Universities Australia. Explore. Choose. Enrol.
Billy Thorpe.
And 100,000 people turned up that day. Summer Jam Festival, stinking hot in Texas. Donna flew out. I was in a great mood. I was showing off in the green room. And
was it love at first sight?
I don't know whether it was love at first sight, but I really felt a connection to her. And I started phoning her every day. I'd be in a different town. She had to fly back for work, you know, and it'd be the same old rock and roll thing, like, hey, you want to fly out to meet me somewhere? She'd always say, I don't think so. You're in a rock and roll band, and, you know, don't be playing with my heart, you know. And this went on for about 3 weeks, and we finally, ironically, we get to Nashville. We had 3 days there, but only one show to play, and we said to Wheatley, you know, Graham and I said, book us into a studio and we'll record some demos of new songs. Well, by this time I was getting the message from Donna that she wasn't going to fly out to meet me anywhere, so I stopped phoning, you know.
Oh.
And then continued on the road, and we went into Canada, came down to Boston, and she'd, this was back in the day where mail was all handwritten. There was no email, no phones,
yeah,
nothing.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
Anyway, on this particular day, I was handed this poster. It was this big and this wide, and I thought, who would be sending me this?
It's,
you know?
Not TV. You had to accept. It was a big poster.
It was a huge poster. You're wrapped in brown paper, no return address. Yeah. So I took it back to my hotel room and tore the paper off, and there in big letters was written, call me, you fade away. And so I picked up the phone and started calling again.
And 40 years later.
And here we are 40 years later, yeah.
You are a bit more spiritual, though, than the average rock.
I'm very spiritual,
no,
yeah.
No,
I am.
I think you found
I'm very strong in my beliefs.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Did that come later?
It came during the second year of Little River Band.
Really?
Yeah.
Did you have an epiphany?
I did. I had an epiphany. I had a distinct spiritual experience that I'd been searching. I'd done the whole thing with Eastern religions and blah, 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 and all that sort of stuff. And I was actually invited to see a movie that was called The Road to Armageddon. And it was based on a book called The Vision that the Reverend David Wilkerson had written. And it was doom and gloom about, you know, this is what's going to happen in the world, blah, 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 all this sort of stuff. You know, I was very skeptical at first. I didn't want to believe any of it, you know. But anyway, we ended up talking it through the night. We were discussing the movie with Graham Goble and his wife. And I went to bed as normal that night. And the next day I woke up and it was like, I wasn't here. Something had happened. And it was like I was really questioning myself, what's going on here, you know, and what's happened to me. And we were flying to Toowoomba to start the tour for After Hours, our second album. And I thought to myself, well, you've kind of been searching in various directions and nothing's really grabbed you. So I walked to the nearest bookstore and bought a Bible.
Really?
Yeah, and
was Donna religious?
No. Oh no, yeah, Donna's strong in her belief too.
Yeah.
But this, I met her later.
Oh, okay.
So this is on my own, and basically that was the start. You know, I read the Bible like from beginning to end, and you know, nothing like fell down on me or anything. Or, you know, there's none of that. But for 3 days, I felt so completely at ease and comfortable in my own skin, kind of thing. It's hard to describe what really happened, you know. But the thing is that it pointed me towards Christianity, and made me believer in the Trinity.
So how do the other rock stars around you react to that?
They don't. I think there's a respect there for what I believe, as much as I respect other people for their faiths.
Is that one of the reasons why you actually ended up leaving LRB? Because you left after about 3 years?
Yeah, but that wasn't the reason I left. The reason I left was because the musical direction of the group was being pushed into a harder rock area, which I didn't feel was right for the band.
Okay. Who was pushing? Glenn, probably?
No, Graham.
Graham.
Graham, yeah.
Graham apparently is quite a strong, determined figure.
He is.
Okay.
He is.
Very pedantic about royalties and...
Yeah.
That's the picture that's painted by... I don't know him.
Yeah.
But is that true? I mean, it must be difficult to...
He is. He's a bit of a manipulator, you know, as far as if he's determined to get something, he will...
Would he agree with you?
Well, Graham and I actually got along very well for the years that we worked together. We were a great team. Yeah. We co-wrote many songs together, and we were more the two guys who worked behind the scenes, okay, as far as we were instrumental in the recording studio and in rehearsals to make the songs what they became.
And Glenn and Graham clashed, is that?
Yeah.
That's
yeah.
Glenn Shrike
and Graham. And basically I was the meat in the sandwich.
So you leave the band.
Yeah.
You don't get paid out, you just leave the band.
Yes.
So that has enormous ramifications a few years down the track when you want to start performing again as Little River Band, doesn't it?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, the band continued on with various members, and, you know, one by one, all of the original members leave. But I think that the critical point here for the loss of the name is the fact that the Capitol Records contract ran out. And then the band got a new recording deal with MCA Records. So for the royalty stream that comes from certain record labels, they had to set up a different entity, a different corporation, so to speak. And so when the rights from the Little River Band Proprietary Limited that had been set up were transferred to a company called We Too Proprietary Limited, which was the conduit for the MCA royalty stream, somehow the trademark and the name of the band got transferred over with it. And then as every one of the original members left, the last man standing was Stephen Housden, who claimed the rights to the name.
I assume you still get royalties from the songs you wrote.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. That's ongoing.
Okay. But you can't perform as the original Little River Band.
No.
We see the original Master and Apprentices perform here in Adelaide, but you can't. So you can sing songs by Little River Band.
Yes.
Any restrictions on those?
Yeah, no. It's kind of like my Evening with B. Birtles. I can pull songs from wherever I like from the bands that I've been in over my career. And I wanted to touch on that with you because, you know, here I am at age 70, and all of a sudden I find like I'm really coming into my own thing now. Whereas over my career, I've always been, Beeb's always been a part of a band, but now I can do my own thing and it feels really good.
Does it?
Yeah.
Do you have to do it financially? Do you have to do it?
No, I want to do it. I want to do this, you know. I had a long time where I didn't perform anymore because at the end of Little River Band had a very short playlist. It was only about 17, 18 songs. That's all we play. We play those songs night after night. And it didn't dawn on me until I had quit the band how much of a robot I had become and that I was up there on stage and I wasn't singing with any feeling anymore. And so I took time away from all of that and went into the studio and worked in the studio and produced younger artists and stuff like that. But now that I'm coming back to it with the desire to really want to sing again.
Well, you're singing better than ever. B. Birtles, Grand Central, Friday the 22nd of February, part of the Fringe. It's a great night out. You can feel an intimate part of Beeb's journey.
I've picked 25 songs from Zoot, Mississippi and Little River Band that I think everybody would really love to hear. Well, most of them are really well-known songs. So, and I've got a great bunch of musicians behind me.
Have you got backing singers?
Yes, got backing singers, and one of which is a female, Nanette Van Ryten.
Yeah.
And, we're in the process of rehearsing.
Are they
right
South
now.
Australian musicians?
South Australian musicians,
okay.
All from Adelaide.
Well done. Yeah. You live in Nashville.
Yeah.
How much of Adelaide is still a part of you?
Well, it's become a bigger part, I think, over the last few years because, you know, I was back here last year for the release of my memoir, but also the induction into the South Australian Music Hall of Fame, which I did with my good friend Barry Smith, and Daryl Cotton was inducted posthumously.
Mm. Barry Smith was from the Town Criers.
That's right.
His family are mad Glenelg supporters. I know that.
Oh, really? Okay, that's great.
It is.
Babe,
it's been a delight. I mean, we haven't been able to do justice to your life and your talent and your and the repertoire that you've had, but it's great to see you back in Adelaide. Folks, you can see Beeb at the Grand Central. The tickets you can get from Fringe Ticks. It's a night with Beeb Birtles. He's singing the songs of Zoot, Mississippi and LRB. Great to have you back, mate.
Thanks, Graham.
Beeb Birtles is my guest, folks, and thank you for joining us.